Yes, and we are back. This is Warning Shots here on CKUW 95.9 FM. Warning Shots is CKUW's independent international news show. And right now, Alex Patterson and I are joined with author and activist Eve Angler. Hello, Eve. Are you there?
How's it going?
Going pretty good.
Thanks for coming on the show today, Eve.
Thanks for having me.
So, your book is about Lester B. Pearson and his influence on Canadian policy, foreign policy, and a way to reimagine it. I think the best way to maybe start our discussions of your book is for people to maybe explain to the listener how you perceive the dominant picture of Lester B. Pearson in the Canadian political culture.
Well, the dominant opinion is that he was a peacekeeper. He won a Nobel Peace Prize. He was an internationalist, and he tried to end conflict around the world. And that's dominant, not just dominant in the sense of sort of mainstream academia or mainstream sort of intellectual culture, but also much of the progressive world. People like Linda McQuaig, former NDP leader Jack Layton, Elizabeth May, Stephen Staples, very much into much of what would be defined as the left, have this sort of this vision of Pearson as this symbol of benevolent Canada.
And I was wondering, why do you think it's important to reevaluate Pearson and his influence on Canadian foreign policy?
Well, most importantly, because there is a straight line between Lester Pearson's foreign policy and Stephen Harper's foreign policy. In many ways, the pro-imperial, pro-military foreign policy that we see today with Stephen Harper's government has its roots in what Lester Pearson was doing, particularly his role in building up the U.S. empire at the end of World War II. Lester Pearson is the main figure within Canadian foreign policy that shifted Canada's orientation from a pro-British imperialism to a pro-American imperialism. And I think that you see a lot of that legacy today with Stephen Harper. Secondarily, there's questions about the use of Pearson, the sort of mythology of Canada's having been a benevolent actor that many people in sort of progressive world tend to cite while criticizing Stephen Harper's foreign policy. It's got its problems in terms of the fact that it downplays the structural character of Canadian foreign policy. If you implicitly argue just between different prime ministers that we either have a Harper, bad Harper foreign policy, or a good Pearson foreign policy, you're downplaying the fact that Canadian foreign policy has always been fundamentally self-serving and fundamentally driven by elite interests, and it's never been close to what the self-professed reasons are of, sort of humanistic or internationalist or whatever different sort of more positive reasons that are usually cited. So I think that if we want to really understand Stephen Harper's foreign policy today, we have to look back to the creation, post-World War II creation of Canadian foreign policy, which Lester Pearson is the dominant figure in for more than two decades.
Now, Eve, in reading the manuscript of the book, one thing that I found interesting is kind of how you to the reader you kind of ask them to sort of use this sort of criteria for critiquing Lester Pearson as if if there was a Truth and Reconciliation Commission for Canadian foreign policy. So talk about kind of the criteria for that and kind of how you frame that this critique of Pearson. I think it's in light of the UN Charter. It's kind of how you put it in light.
Exactly. I mean, Pearson was you can look back on historical figures. You could look back at lots of politicians and say, hey, they were racists. They said all these horrible things against indigenous people or black people or whatever. Looking from today in the sort of breaking down of certain racial stereotypes today that has transpired. So you can look back and criticize people, politicians, you know, rightfully so, for their, you know, their different policies. But what we're doing with the UN Charter is actually using criteria that Pearson was involved in ostensibly involved in creating. So it's not like looking back and sort of judging him his foreign policy unfairly, but it's judging him by the criteria that he claimed to support in the creation of the UN Charter, which of course happens at right at the end of World War II. And in terms of the truth and reconciliation idea, it's basically, you know, looking at it. Noam Chomsky, who writes a foreword to the book, considers Pearson a war criminal. As someone who doesn't have a particular legal background, you know, I'm not sure if I'm in a position to judge, but in the book, you just sort of put it forward through the idea of having a Truth and Reconciliation Commission to look into Pearson's foreign policy. And I think that, you know, this is not just it's not just sort of an academic exercise, kind of after the fact. This stuff, even though Pearson's been dead for 50 years, it is still a legacy of Canadian foreign policy that continues today. He's still a political figure that is mentioned repeatedly, in the House of Commons today in debates about foreign policy. So I think it would be valuable, actually, if there was, even if there was some sort of popular Truth and Reconciliation Commission that could be established to look into some of these historical, in my view, wrongs, and that's up to the readers to decide. And I think that would help in sort of moving us forward in terms of getting towards a more just foreign policy today.
Yeah. Now, I guess a place to begin is to kind of talk about Pearson during the Cold War and sort of the policies that he was in favor of. I mean, I guess the place to start would be, I suppose, maybe the Korean War, where you detail it. So could you talk a bit about that and sort of Pearson's, I guess, position as very much as they would say it, a cold warrior?
Yeah, I mean, reading through the House of Commons debates, 14 years of Pearson's time as external minister, then prime minister in the House of Commons debates on foreign policy, he was an over-the-top cold warrior. I mean, he talked about stuff like the Slavic Empire was, you know, coming to get us or whatever. It's stuff that reads today completely. It seems totally ludicrous reading it today. But it was, you know, in the height of sort of Cold War kind of times. I guess it was effective or somewhat effective in scaring people in terms of getting the population behind foreign policy. So he was, you know, strong in terms of his comments, but also in terms of deed. And an important one was his role. I mean, he basically got to the point of threatening to resign as external minister if Canada didn't send ground troops to Korea. Both the Prime Minister Saint Laurent and the Defense Minister were at the time a little bit uncomfortable about sending ground troops. Canada had already sent some naval vessels to support the U.S. War in Korea, which was done under the UN banner, which was it was actually a U.S. General MacArthur that headed up the war under a UN banner. But it was not subject to UN control; it was just subject to U.S. Control. And this was a war, the Korean War, that led to three or so million people being killed. It was a savagely brutal affair with UN bombers, which were really U.S. bombers. Basically destroying every building of more than two stories in North Korea, just incredible numbers of civilian losses. And Pearson, you know, basically threatened to resign if Canada didn't wholeheartedly engage, and ultimately 27,000 Canadian troops fought in Korea. And there's this one passage where the New York Times reports on a small hamlet of a few hundred North Koreans that is simply wiped out. All but one or two people are left in this hamlet, and a New York Times reporter covers this U.S. bombing raid, which has included chemical weapons. And Pearson's response to seeing this thing in the New York Times was to send a letter down to the Canadian ambassador in Washington to ask why the U.S. media censors, which are taking place that censored reports from the war, why they hadn't blocked this report from making it into the paper. He was concerned that, you know, this might affect Asian opinion. He wasn't concerned about the fact that a couple hundred people were killed. And to me, that was very indicative of just his, you know, his sort of power politics kind of mentality, and obviously a very strong Cold War ideology that you know, ultimately justified all kinds of horrendous crimes.
And just for clarification, this Pearson's view was not the most progressive view at the time either.
No, for sure. It was certainly not the most progressive view. There were other people criticizing, you know, within Canadian civil society, criticizing the war in Korea. But I do have to say, unfortunately, you did have a situation where the CCF basically went along with it, even though actually in some ways the Prime Minister was a bit more ambivalent about sending ground troops. The CCF was a bit more... was actually fairly supportive of policy, which was again tied into that's a sort of somewhat of an aside, but tied into the Cold War ideology of the day. But certainly no, there were progressive voices, and Pearson was very critical of those progressive voices that were opposed to what was going on in Korea.
Yeah. Now, moving on from there, I mean, the next place in Asia would be in Vietnam. Now, I guess first start with the Canadian support for the French in Indochina, and then I guess talk a bit about the sort of this more, I guess it would be less progressive policy that Canada had in Vietnam.
Yeah, well, I mean, the first phase is Pearson was strongly backed the French attempt to reestablish control of Vietnam after World War II. It had been a French colony, and particularly Pearson was particularly supportive once the Americans were fully reengaged with the Vietnamese, which partly took place after the Chinese Revolution of 1949. So there were significant amounts of Canadian weapons that were sent under the NATO's mutual assistance program to the French while they were putting down or attempting to put down the anti-colonial struggle, the independence struggle in Vietnam led by Ho Chi Minh. So that's you know, he was both rhetorically supportive and again indeed with Canadian weapons being sent. Fast forward a few years, the North Vietnamese are ultimately successful. The Americans and the French are able to establish a puppet regime in the south. And with time, there becomes obviously a full fledged American military role in Vietnam, brutal occupation, which is, you know, I'm sure most listeners are quite familiar with. Pearson helped, as Prime Minister, Pearson helped Americans in a whole series of ways. Obviously, there was significant amounts of Canadian weapons that were sold to the Americans while they were fighting in Vietnam. Rhetorical support, repeated, again, it's incredible. People repeatedly cite Pearson as having opposed the war. Well, I went to the Hansard, the parliamentary debates. In his own words, time after time after time in the House of Commons, Pearson said explicitly comments that were supportive of the American war. You know, as explicitly as I support the U.S. war in Vietnam. Not more convoluted than that. And yet he is cited by people like Linda McQuaig as having supposedly opposed the war in Vietnam, even though in his own words, again, he repeatedly cites it. But the most kind of dubious or I guess you could go so far as calling criminal role that Pearson played in the American war in Vietnam was that Pearson in 1964, and this was reported on in the Pentagon Papers, the internal American government documents, he had a meeting with Lyndon Johnson, then the president of the U.S., after Kennedy dies, and he said he was prepared to have Canada's commissioner to the International Control Commission, Canada was one of three members of the International Control Commission, which was supposed to bring the reunification of Vietnam and bring peace to Vietnam. And Pearson had the Canadian commissioner of the ICC deliver American bombing threats to the North Vietnamese. So Canadian ICC Commissioner Seaborne would go to the North Vietnamese leadership and say, if you don't stop your supposed aggression in South Vietnam, which was obviously non-existent, it was, you know, of course, American aggression. But he'd say to the North Vietnamese, if you don't do this, we will bomb you. And then the Americans ultimately do obviously bomb North Vietnam, somewhere around 100,000 people are killed in these American bombings of North Vietnam. So Pearson had Canada play a very clear role, real serious complicity in this American war crime in North Vietnam. And I think that's the primary reason why someone like Noam Chomsky would see Pearson as a war criminal. But it was just a general, there's also just a general support for the U.S. war in Vietnam.
Moving on from Pearson's participation in warmongering against Vietnam, I was wondering if you could detail his role in constructing NATO and what the intentions of creating NATO were for Pearson and the other people that were creating it.
Yeah, that to me was actually probably the most interesting part of the research in this book, is the question of NATO. Pearson says in his biography that the formation of NATO was the most important thing he did. That's his words, the most important thing he was involved in. Which would surprise many people, because if most Canadians think of Pearson as you know, peacekeeping, and that would be the reason they would, the quote unquote, the most important thing he did. But Pearson was very clear that it was about NATO. And leaving aside the peacekeeping question, and really what the peacekeeping mission was about in '56 was actually about protecting NATO, the division between the French and British versus the Americans after the invasion of Egypt, and that was what the intent of peacekeeping was. But back to the question of the creation of peacekeeping. Pearson said very explicitly that in debates in House of Commons that peacekeeping was for, he had a very expansionist view, sorry, not peacekeeping, NATO had a very expansionist view of NATO, that NATO was about basically Western European U.S. control of the world. And so he said repeatedly about how, you know, with the creation of NATO, we can't let the Middle East go towards the Russians. Similarly, he said similar comments about Southeast Asia. So he had a very, and then if you look at the Canadian weapons being sent to the, through NATO, NATO's mutual assistance program, being sent to the French as they put down independence movements in Algeria or in Vietnam, you know, there was concrete deeds behind that vision of NATO. Similarly, with the NATO assistance that went to the Belgians while they were involved in colonial their colonies in Africa, and so that was one part of it was a very and I think that's a very important point until today. You look at NATO wars, you know, in Afghanistan today. You look at NATO war in Libya. I think there's a strong parallel between how Pearson saw NATO's creation back in 1947, 48, 49. Well, it was formally created in 49, but he was involved in these negotiations, these secret negotiations beforehand, and what we're seeing today with NATO wars in Libya and Afghanistan. The other part of the motivation for, not the central part of motivation for creating NATO, was there was fear that the communist parties, socialist movements in Europe, in Western Europe, particularly in France and Italy, were going to come to power, and there was a real sense among the elite and amongst the population that, you know, communism was the wave of the future. And so what NATO was about, in part, was about strengthening the resolve of the Western European elite in the face of strong you know, communist movements, because of course during World War II, the communists were often in the resistance in France or in Italy, and so they were well seen by the population, whereas the elite sectors, the traditional elite sectors, were obviously tied in with either Nazism or Mussolini or you know, the you know, the horrors of that. So after World War II, there was a lot of support for you know, communist movements in those places. And this is not in any way being directed by Moscow. These were indigenous communist movements. Which, you know, almost came to power, got over 30% of the vote in France, almost came to power in Italy. And so Pearson, again, when talking about, you know, at this time, when talking about NATO, who was pretty explicit that he was they were concerned about, you know, he would refer to labor movements, the labor struggles in Europe and Western Europe, and you know, he really equated the creation of NATO and putting troops. And there were NATO secret NATO protocols that had something called Operation Gladio, which basically had agreements that the different NATO countries would do what they could to stop communist parties coming to power. They would frame that as if it was something coming from Moscow, but in effect, what they were really talking about is indigenous communist movements coming to power in Italy or elsewhere.
Could you maybe briefly describe for the listeners some of Canada's planning in preventing communists from coming to power, including Profunk?
Yeah, no, that's a pretty interesting stuff. There's a book called Operation Gladio that goes into the secret protocols between the different NATO countries in the case of, you know, communist movement, and Canada is one of the two countries left out, one of the two NATO members left out of that book in terms of detailing it. The author gets all kinds of details, but all the other, I think, 14 other countries, but not Canada. But what we do know, as was reported by CBC and Enquête of Radio-Canada about a year and a half ago, they had two shows that went into Profunct, which was the Canadian plan, began in 1950. That was an operation for more than three decades. That basically, it was Profunk was stood for prominent functionaries of the Communist Party. I think it was the name, and it was basically a plan that, in the case of a communist disturbance, that the police had all this intelligence on thousands. I think it's into tens of thousands of Canadians to take those people. To imprison those people, these were supposedly, you know, alleged sympathizers with communism, to basically jail these people if there was this communist disturbance. I have no conclusive proof, but my sense is this happened the year after NATO, and I think this is probably tied into the larger, the Profunk was tied into the larger NATO agreements around this issue.
I guess kind of moving again, jumping to a different part of the world, but also talk about Pearson's at the time, you know, his involvement in things like in Brazil. You talk about, you know, support of kind of like private companies and stuff like that, as well as in the support of United Fruit, which became Chiquita Banana. In Guatemala. So you can talk about maybe kind of give an overview of sort of some of the things that Pearson was involved with as far as South America is concerned.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of the coup in Guatemala in 1954, that got rid of Arbenz, who was a mild reformist, but a reformist trying to advance some sort of social democratic reforms, particularly in terms of land reform, that were bitterly resisted by United Fruit, a major American corporation, and bitterly resisted by the U.S. government. Pearson was went along with the coup quite clearly. He, a couple of occasions, as external minister at this time, Pearson refused Guatemala's to establish ambassadors in the two countries, and this was, part of a plan of isolating the Arbenz government. There was, just a general sort of rhetorical, House of Commons, not a strong, I would say, strong support, but the NDP or the CCF at the time was criticizing, were asking questions that were going in the direction of criticism of what was going on in Guatemala. And Pearson said, "Oh no, this is just an indigenous uprising against Arbenz. In fact, we know it's there was, and they knew at the time, of course, was the Americans were basically organized the whole thing, and were without the U.S. this would not have this uprising against Arbenz would not have happened." So Pearson was supportive of the U.S. policy there. You look at his policy vis-a-vis Cuba. he was Cuban ambassadors were aware of this. They were concerned about Pearson becoming prime minister. The Cuban ambassador here in Ottawa was concerned about Pearson becoming prime minister because he was known as being an ardently, you know, strong Cold Warrior, ardently against Cuba. And this was before, you know, in 1962, before he becomes prime minister. Similarly, if you look at the coup in Brazil against Goulart in 64, which was a, you know, U.S.-backed coup, Canadian company Braskem, Brazilian Traction, largest company in Latin America at the time, huge Toronto-based company. It was called called it the Canadian Octopus because it had its tentacles in so many parts of the Brazilian economy. They were very strongly in support of the coup against Goulart. And similarly, you see the comments from Pearson and from the Canadian government at the time were generally in favor of that. And actually, there were lots of former Braskem officials that were in different ministerial positions within the Pearson government. So his policy vis-a-vis Latin America. So lots of people will call him, you know, Pearson an internationalist. And I think that you know, that's generally the case. He generally preferred, you know, UN or NATO solutions to what's going on in the world. But when it came to Latin America, he was very happy to support unilateral U.S. Interventions, unilateral U.S. imperial interventions, and I think the most part, the reason why he supported international institutions was because he understood that they were generally better in terms of creating legitimacy. But when the chips were down, he was more than happy to support a unilateral American intervention, as was the case in Guatemala or elsewhere.
All of these instances of Pearson's record in mind, how would you overall characterize his relationship to the United States Empire?
I think he was a strong supporter of the U.S. Empire, and the one distinction I'd like to make with some people is that often people will say that the extent to which Canadian foreign policy was pro-U.S. was because Washington forced Ottawa to do it. And I think what Pearson shows, what looking at Pearson carefully shows, is that he was prodding the Americans in 47, 48, 49 onwards. He was prodding the Americans for a more expansionist policy. His role in the creation of NATO was very much, he saw that tying Canada, and when I talk about Canada, what I'm really talking about is the Canadian elite. He saw that the Canadian elite would benefit from the expansion of the U.S. empire. And I think there's no country in the world where the elite would be better integrated between the Canadian and U.S. elite. No other country would be better integrated to U.S. elite than in Canada, business-wise, culturally, obviously politically. And so I think Pearson to his credit, he saw the changing dynamics in the world, and he saw that it made sense to tie Canada, the Canadian, militarily, politically, into the expanding U.S. empire, and also again to prod that empire forward. And again, I think what we see today with Stephen Harper, to a large extent, is the legacy of those decisions, those post-World War II decisions of bringing Canada, Canadian foreign policy, in aligned with the new world hegemon, the United States.
In the foreword, Noam Chomsky writes about how, he kind of refers to Pearson as a war criminal. So do you think that's a fair assessment, or what's your opinion on that after doing this research?
In terms of the legality of these things, I don't have a whole lot of expertise in terms of to what extent does the where's that line between when the complicity and then and that becomes a level of criminality. Clearly, Pearson supported actively supported a number of war crimes. Most obviously, the U.S. bombing of North Vietnam, but also I think that if you look at what he did in Korea, the Korean, the politics of what happened in Korea are much more confused or a bit more unclear to most people. So it's less often cited, but clearly Canada was involved in war crimes in Korea and in aiding and abetting war crimes in Korea. And Pearson saw little problem with that. So my sense is that Chomsky is correct. I think that it would be worthwhile political exercise, historical exercise, to actually have a genuine truth and reconciliation commission. I mean, the man's dead. The man's been dead for 50 years, so there is no actual criminal charges that could be brought against Pearson. But I think from a political standpoint, to look into this seriously. And I think that it's not just about the individual. I think Pearson as an individual, he was a, from what I can tell, from what I'm reading the different biographies, he seemed a nice father. He seemed like a friendly person in his personal relations. But it's, I think really what it is a question of structural issues. And Pearson represented a whole power structure within Canadian society. Within obviously the government, but more broadly within the economic system that we live within, and I think that going through the political exercise of making the case for why he was a war criminal, or conversely for why he wasn't a war criminal, I think it would help us in understanding the history of Canadian foreign policy, which has importance until today.
Thanks so much for going into Pearson's history with us, Yves. You're coming to Winnipeg on the 15th?
Yes, March 15th. Should be doing an event there. So it'd be great if people could come out to that.
Is that the Mondragon, I would assume?
I don't actually know. I don't know the venue. Paul Graham is setting stuff up. I don't actually know the specifics of that.
Okay.
Well, we'll make sure the listeners know in March when your event is, so they can connect with you and pick up the book and all those types of things. So thanks for coming on, and we look forward to your next kick at the can on taking on Canadian foreign policy in some way.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Yves.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
So, we have a track coming up called Rebel Warrior, and it's kind of what I wish Pearson had have been rather than an imperialist warrior.